Welcome to the
Republican. Yeah. Yip, 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 yip. Ripa, ripa, ripa. Andale, andale, andale.
Republican professor, I'm your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. We're back in the office, and we have a swell reading from The Age of Entitlement. This book, I'm telling you, man, this book defines and explains the wokeness that we've seen that annoys so many of us and have destroyed the workplace, have destroyed the universities. This book is providing a lot there in terms of context and explanation. And we're in the middle of the race chapter. We stopped in our reading with his analysis of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. We were on page 19. This is a book by Chris Caldwell, one of my favorite writers in American politics. And it's published by Scheinman and Schuster, yeah, New York. We'd like to thank Simon and Schuster for making this material available. We'd like to thank Chris Caldwell for writing it. We're going to make a fair use, do a transformative reading of The Age of Entitlement, America Since the 60s. Go out and get a copy of it. Go to Narns and Bobel. Go to a physical bookstore. Get a physical copy of it. You're not going to be disappointed. This one was sent to me by my former student, Matt Stone, Political Philosophy, Moorpark College, 2008 fall. Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it. Page 19. What did whites think they were getting from the Civil Rights Act of 1964? The mood of that public is hard to gauge. Chris Caldwell starts there in chapter 2 of this section. Certainly, many white people, and I'm going to add here, remember, this is a transformative reading, okay? I'm going to add here that these are so-called white people. Right, Chris? Right? You ever have Crayola crowns? You ever see? It says white on that. You compare it with your skin, it's different. It's not the same. So-called white. Certainly, many white people did wish for the Civil Rights Revolution. In the last summer of John F. Kennedy's life, a plurality, 49 to 42%, said they favored a law that would give all persons, Negro as well as white, and these are original, I'm just reading it, okay? That's the original language, okay? The right to be served in public places such as hotels, restaurants, theaters, and similar establishments. That right would be at the core of the Civil Rights Act of 1965, signed by Kennedy's successor, Lyndon Johnson. But the act, as we have seen, went further still, and 5 months after pushing it through Congress, Johnson won the presidency with 61% of the popular vote, the highest tally in American history. Let's just stop there for a sec. Did Johnson run again? He could have. He could have. He could have. Did he run again in 1968? Yes or no? He got the highest popular vote in history. 4 years later, he could have run again. Did he? Yes or no? As the Germans say, 10. Wow, I got it wrong again. 11. No, 9. 9. That's how fast things can change in American politics. Don't get cocky. Not to bring up health food, but let us continue. It does not seem likely that Johnson's election victory constituted voter endorsement, given the two decades of steady nationwide conservative drift. I don't like that term conservative, Chris, but okay. Conservative drift that began almost simultaneously. Democrats would lose 47 House seats at the next midterm election, making the 1964 landslide look less like a validation of Johnson than a tribute to Kennedy. Johnson had framed his civil rights legislation, such as a tribute. Johnson had framed his civil rights legislation as such a tribute. For a while after Kennedy's death, he framed most issues that way. Quote, no memorial oration or eulogy could more eloquently honor President Kennedy's memory than the earliest possible passage of the Civil Rights Bill for which he's fought so long, Johnson said in an address to Congress 5 days after the assassination. And continuing the quote, and second, no act of ours could more fittingly continue the work of President Kennedy than the early passage of the tax bill for which he fought all this long year, unquote. The Gallup polling organization routinely asked Americans in the early 1960s whether they believed the pace of integration was too fast, not fast enough, or about right. You guys getting this? In August 1963, the month of March, the March on Washington, at which Martin Luther King Jr. gave his I Have a Dream speech, 50% said the country was moving too fast on integration versus 10% who said not fast enough. A ratio of 5 to 1. 5 to 1. Okay. That ratio fell to 2 to 1, 30 to 15% in January during the debate over the Civil Rights Act. But in October, on the eve of the election, it was back over 3 to 1, 57 to 18% again. It never disappeared. Page 20 at the top. Whites were muddle-headed on the subject of race. It is clear that they did not understand that the Civil Rights Act was a big constitutional deal. And you know what? He keeps using that word constitutional. I have issues with some of what Chris says here and the constitutional word I have issues with. This is just a mere statute. It's a mere you need to drill it into your head. It's just a statute, okay? It's not constitutional. But he's using constitutional language. We're going to go with how he says it. Three weeks before the 1964 elections, Gallup asked the following question. Some people say the civil rights law guaranteeing equal rights for Negroes, again, original language, should be strictly enforced right from the beginning. Others say a gradual persuasive approach should be used at first. Which approach would you rather see used? What a question, Chris continues. The law had already passed. It was on the books. Again, it's just a law. It's a statute. It's not a constitutional amendment. It had capped a months-long political campaign that aimed to resolve a centuries-long legacy of quarreling and bloodshed. And now, Gallup was asking whether the country should enforce it? The pollsters, however, had a reason for asking. fewer than a quarter of Americans actually did want the law to be enforced. Here's how they answered. 23% strictly enforced, 62% gradual persuasive approach, 10% depends on circumstances, 6% don't know. Jeez. The answer was no fluke. After the election, the Opinion Research Corporation asked a similar question. In the era of civil rights, which government policy do you favor? Vigorous enforcement of new civil rights law or moderation enforcement of the new civil rights law? And got almost identical results. 19% vigorous enforcement of the new civil rights law. 68% moderate enforcement of the new civil rights law. 13% no choice. Wow. This is very insightful. I don't know anybody else that would write a book like this. For all the pious sentiments about desegregating the South, by the way, which was entirely Democrat, for the most part, 90%, whites opposed every single activist step that might have brought desegregation about, and every single activist who was working to do so. In 1961, they thought by a margin of 57% to 28% that the black students staging sit-ins at North Carolina lunch counters and the freedom riders occupying segregated buses between Washington, D.C. and New Orleans hurt rather than helped the cause of civil rights. In 1964, see, that was 1961. In 1964, on the eve of the Civil Rights Act, only 16% of Americans said that mass demonstrations had helped the cause of racial equality versus 74% who said they heard it. 60% even disapproved of the march in Washington. Jeez, 60%, wow. At least in the days leading up to it, while only 23% approved. Why is Chris going through this stuff? Why is Caldwell going through this stuff? Yeah, think about that. I'm enjoying a beverage in my San Diego County gun owners beer mug. See episodes 8 and 9 on the Republican Professor podcast for more context. We continue on page 21 in the middle. Most Americans, liberal as well as conservative, and again, these terms are so squirrely. I don't like the use of these terms. Okay, just putting it on the record there. Most Americans, liberal as well as conservative, saw the race problem as something distant. It had to do only or mainly with the exotic culture of the South where segregation was legal. The problem was almost one of foreign policy. Yeah. Democrat versus Republican going back to the Civil War. That's true. The sociologist of race, Alan David Freeman, wrote of how sitting in an all-white fifth-grade classroom in New York City in 1954, he had found out about the Brown decision. I can recall distinctly the response of my own naive liberal consciousness. The law is now going to make those bad Southerners behave. As white people in the northern and western states saw it, racial harmony had arrived long ago. In August of 1962, with the school year about to begin, 83% of Americans told Gallup that blacks in their community had the same opportunities as white children to get a good education. Gallup kept asking this question as the 1960s wore on, and white Americans' views changed little. At the end of the 1967-1968 school year, 70% told pollsters that blacks in their community were treated the same as whites, and only 20% said they were treated not very well or badly. Outside the South, white people seemed to believe it would be a simple matter to get rid of segregation, as if a system of racial oppression so intricate and ingenious that it had taken 3.5 centuries to devise could be dismantled overnight by sheer open-minded niceties at no price in rights to anyone. Page 22 at the top. Age of Entitlement, Chris Caldwell. Simon & Schuster, 2020, New York. Get your copy today. Support your local bookstore. We'd like to thank Simon & Schuster for making this material available. We'd like to thank Chris Caldwell for writing it. We're going to make a fair use, do a transformative reading of this material. Page 22 at the top. The country could solve a problem of institutional racism without altering any of its institutions. What we find most amazing about this ideological structure in retrospect, Kimberly Crenshaw and a group of scholarly race theorists would write 3 decades later, is how little actual social change was imagined to be required by the Civil Rights Revolution. Crenshaw and her colleagues were right. That is indeed the most amazing thing about the Civil Rights Revolution. Americans' basically wrong assessment explains why problems emerged so soon after the passage of the civil rights legislation. It may also explain why the legislation passed in the first place. This is very interesting. Pay close attention to what I'm about to read, the next paragraph. If you are barely paying attention now, you want to drop what you're doing and listen carefully. If you're washing dishes, stop. Just turn it off. Listen to what I'm saying. Page 22 in the middle. As a practical matter, whites did not suspect they would see the vast increase in federal government oversight that would become the sine non qua of civil rights. The congressional debate leading up to the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is filled with outright mockery of those who warned of some hitherto unimaginable federal government infringement. Not just the regulation of Mrs. Murphy's rooming house mentioned above, but also mandatory school busing, public and private hiring quotas, and immigration quotas. In the spring of 1964, when Florida Democratic Senator George Smathers worried that attempts to equalize school enrollment might lead to busing, his Pennsylvania Republican colleague Hugh Scott scoffed, "Does the senator not agree that there is nothing whatever in the bill which relates to the transportation of school by bus from one district to the other? I find nothing in the bill which pertains to any such provision." By the 1970s, there was race-based busing nationwide, and not just in the southern states. All sorts of constitutionalist and libertarian fears chuckled at and poo-pooed on the floor of the Senate came to pass. Those who opposed the legislation proved wiser about its consequences than those who sponsored it. White civil rights supporters, even the most street smart among them, were inclined to view the civil rights movement not as an attack on America's Constitution and culture, but as an opportunity for everyone in the South to buy into it. Southern whites, whether they realized it or not, would be getting a better deal, full membership in the country's constitutional culture. And it was hard to imagine that blacks who would be getting a much better deal would respond with anything other than gratitude. Looking back from the late 1970s at a vanished golden age of harmony between whites and blacks, the Harvard sociologist Nathan Glazier recalled that interracial fraternity was certainly the objective of the American Negro Civil Rights Movement until the 1960s. Black leaders wanted nothing more than to be Americans, full Americans, with the rights of all Americans. But by the time Glazer wrote, he could see what Wechsler had predicted. Giving blacks access to the rights of all Americans would mean redefining those rights, starting with freedom of association. Page 23, in the middle. The proudest achievement of the American model of ethnic assimilation was its pluralism. Even if suburban parts of the country appeared to be growing blander and more homogeneous, they had issued out of and still coexisted with a thrilling and varied culture of mostly European inheritance, Jewish yeshivas, Chinese restaurants, Italian Catholic folk festivals, Slovak veteran lodges and Irish musical groups, Polish trade unions, and even Anglo-Saxon yacht clubs. Civil rights legislation put not just Jim Crow, but all of American culture up for re-examination and renegotiation. For one of the major groups in American life, Glazer wrote of black people, the idea of pluralism, which has supported the various developments of other groups, has become a mockery. Whatever concrete definition we give to pluralism, it means a limitation of government power, a relatively free hand for private and voluntary organizations to develop their own patterns of worship, education and social life, residential concentration, and even distinctive economic activity. All of these enhance the life of some groups. From the perspective of the American Negro, they are exclusive and discriminatory. Again, I'm using the word Negro because that's the word that is used. Page 24 at the top. Subcommunities, as Glazer called them, were often suspicious, hostile to outsiders. They were also indispensable for giving people of humble prospects a dignified place in the social order and keeping the ruthless machinery of market competition at bay. That's very insightful. Quote, the force of present-day Negro demands, Glazer wrote, is that the subcommunity, because it either protects or privileges or creates inequality, has no right to exist, unquote. There's a lot of these quotes and unquotes I'm not sharing. I chose to share that one. Now government would set about destroying those subcommunities. Let me say that again. Pay attention. Now government would set about destroying those subcommunities, eventually doing so in the name of, quote, diversity, unquote. Although that is a story for another chapter. And let me tell you, that chapter is a doozy. The next section is, what did blacks think they were getting? The mainstream white assessment of the race problem of the 1960s and of the scope, of the actions needed to remedy it was mostly wrong. It erred wildly on the side of optimism. Okay, I need to get another sip. This is from Tap, the Tap. Yeah. White people, again, I'm using his language, so-called white people, knew a lot less about black people than blacks did about white people. Whites had not thought that much about what it would be like to live in close proximity to blacks. If indeed they thought it would be, that would be the result of civil rights legislation at all. In part, they were blinded by their privileged position, Alan David Freeman explained. Even when they concur in seeing a system of racial discrimination as evil, outsiders and insiders, or, quote, victims, unquote, and, quote, perpetrators, unquote, as Freeman calls them, tend to look at different things. Victims see racial discrimination as a system of corruption that burdens them in a variety of practical, measurable ways, with, quote, lack of jobs, lack of money, lack of housing, unquote. They are unlikely to view the system as repaired until those practical burdens are removed. All right. Okay. Perpetrators, on the other hand, see an ethical failure on the part of society's leaders and feel society will have done its duty as soon as most people are behaving ethically, speaking out against prejudice and refraining from acts of overt discrimination. Yeah. It's very different. I can't get it to stop. Sorry, I just keep looking at this microphone. I'm tempted to stop using this microphone. The mostly northern whites. The mostly northern whites who legislated against Jim Crow saw themselves as making a grand and magnanimous gesture, cutting a heroic figure. They would affirm the moral principles on which the Constitution rested by extending its legal principles to a region where they had never really been applied. Black people and the most zealous among the civil rights activists of all races saw whites as having entered a guilty plea in the court of history and thus as repudiating the moral posturing on which the good name and the good conscience of their constitutional republic had rested. That is really good prose. These are matters of perspective. There's no point in describing one interpretation as morally right or wrong. We can say, though, that where the black consensus differed from the white consensus it was the blacks' views that were the were more congruent with the reality of what would be required and what would be effective in bringing racial equality about. Page 25 in the middle. The major polling companies did not do intensive work on black opinion until the late 1960s. Itself an instructive datum concerning the kind of reform American elites thought they were launching. When the pollsters looked, they discovered that blacks' views were in most cases the opposite of whites. 60% of blacks believed that progress on civil rights was too slow, not as most whites did, too fast. By 69% to 9%, blacks reckoned federal anti-poverty programs a boost rather than a hindrance. And when riots eventually came in big cities and on college campuses, blacks leaned toward thinking they helped more than hurt integration by 41 to 30% and 40 to 32% respectively, versus the 74% of whites mentioned earlier who said just the opposite. Civil rights, as many blacks saw it, was not just a reform, but also an uprising. Okay. Okay. We're going to stop there because it's Saturday night and I have to work tomorrow at the church. But I wanted to give you another episode of this. Where is he going with this? He's going somewhere that you're going to be surprised by. I'll give you a few tidbits here. He's hard on Reagan, but not in the ways that Democrats would probably say. He prepares a contrast of Trump and Reagan, where Trump looks a lot more competent than Reagan. And that's all I'm going to say. That's all I'm going to say right now. I don't know if you know, but a lot of blacks are coming to the Republican Party again. Welcome. Welcome. Welcome, welcome. And this is background that's very refreshing and interesting and important indeed. Thanks for joining me on the Republican Professor podcast. I've been your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. It is 1 November, 2025, years after Jesus. We'll see you next time.